thank you, Ken. It's lovely to be here. So today we're going to be looking at devotion, which is lovely. It's very heartwarming for this evening. I'm sure we all need some of that. So before we start, as always, we're going to begin with a consecration or a yajna. And consecrate really just means to make sacred. So what we're doing is we're recognizing that our time together is sacred. We're putting ourselves in a sacred space, and we're offering to share those benefits with all beings and offer the karmic fruits to others. So the way we do that is just really just by closing the eyes and beginning to relax so that we can move out of the mind and really into that heart space. So maybe you can feel yourself just relaxing into your chair or wherever you are. And beginning to soften the jaw and the shoulders, keeping the spine straight. And maybe moving the awareness to the breath to begin with, just in order to let go of all the thoughts. And then shifting that awareness down into the heart, whatever that means for you, wherever you believe the center of your soul to be. For me, it's the center of the chest, but for others, it's their belly, wherever it is for you. And then bringing our whole heart to this consecration, we're just going to ask that all the blessings we receive in the next hour, and indeed maybe all of our day today, we offer them to be shared with everyone. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, 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 peace, peace, peace. And then we'll just take a deep breath together and open the eyes. So I'm really excited about this evening and being able to talk about bhakti yoga. I'm just going to type that into the room. So, bhakti yoga. So last week we talked about karma yoga, and that was, so if you remember or if you were there, yoga really means just becoming one with who we are, becoming one with our true nature. Self-realization would be another word for that, or enlightenment, just this union with our full self, with our self with a capital S. And so karma yoga actually meant like having every action that we do is for that purpose of realizing our oneness. And then the Gita talks, it's seen really as being a book that talks about karma yoga, but it also talks about jnana yoga, which is the yoga of wisdom. So that would be realizing yourself through the study of scriptures, through wisdom, through understanding. And then there's bhakti yoga, it mentions, which is the yoga of the heart, it's the yoga of devotion. So it's reaching God or enlightenment or truth through a path of devotion, through devoting yourself in all of your actions. And we're going to get into that a bit later, like what does it really mean? So it says the Gita is predominantly seen as a book of karma yoga. And the Puranas, let me just type that in, tend to be seen as the yogic texts for the bhaktis, for the devotees. And the Puranas are actually different tales of different devas, different gods, and then they contain different rituals and means of worshipping and prayers for those particular devas. But the Gita is actually very embedded within the bhakti yoga tradition as well, even though people tend to think of it as being more about karma yoga. And at one point within the Gita, you know, Krishna even says to Arjuna, because remember it's a tale of Krishna talking to Arjuna and giving him teachings. And Krishna says to Arjuna that it's only because of Arjuna's love for Krishna that he's even allowing him to hear and see. He reveals himself and is cosmic form at some point during the Gita, but it's really just because of Arjuna's love for Krishna that he's even there. And if you remember, even at the beginning of this battle, you know, we're shown Arjuna's love for Krishna because Krishna offers him his armies, which Duryodhana, his sort of evil cousin, takes. But Arjuna says, no, all I want is you, Krishna. I love you and I want you by my side. So we know that this really sort of has a foundation of devotion already, the Gita. But it talks in quite a lot of detail about what it means to be devoted and this path of bhakti yoga. What is it? And I just wanted to talk about the difference between bhakti yoga and jnana yoga. And Ram Dass talks about this idea, and I know I've struggled. I myself tend to think of myself as more as a bhakti than any other, although I really just, you know, I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books that I pore over. And so jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, I've always seen myself as both. And sometimes that confuses me. So I'm just going to read what Ram Dass says here about the two, and I think it really clears up any issues people have around devotion. And it says that the difference between the jnanas and the bhaktis, you can sometimes call it some of the head guys and some of the heart guys. So that the jnanis will say, you know, don't buy into all the emotion, whereas the bhaktis will say, it's okay, drown in the ocean of love, let yourself go and cry and be moved. So in contrast, devotion can look pretty sloppy and mushy, says Ram Dass, while the intellect side looks very clean and very tight. But one sage in India, when he was asked to compare jnana and bhakti yoga, said that jnana yoga is like a lamp, and bhakti yoga is like a gem. So the gem only glows by reflected light. You need that wisdom, while the lamp is its own illumination. So, but a lamp constantly requires attention, like more oil or a new wick, whereas the gem will go on glowing without any effort on its part. That's really saying that, you know, once you've ignited bhakti yoga within you, you just stay glowing and glowing and glowing. Whereas there is jnana yoga, it's a constant studying of scriptures. It's a constant trying to understand. So the main objection that the jnanis usually raise about bhakti yoga is that it's dualistic. So in the case of this sort of analogy, there is the gem and there is the light source. So I often thought about this myself because I felt like I feel very devotional and it seems very odd to me to not go around thanking something or giving my love to something. And I was worried that that was going to keep me in this constant dualistic world. I was seeing myself as separate from this other, from this God, from truth, from oneness, whatever it is that, you know, that word I don't really know to express that, that I was in devotion to. And I, as I say, so I was concerned that I was creating a separation because of my devotion. And this is what the jnanis actually say about the bhaktis, that this is what they're doing. They're living in this dualistic world. And I was so concerned. I wrote to Deepak Chopra and I asked him if he could share some advice about it. And his response was, if your heart is devotional, then just be devoted. Because in the end, we are all one and you will get to the stage where we'll realize that. But for now, if you're feeling drawn to love and drawn to that path of devotion, just follow it. So, Ram Dass just sort of explains here in his book about the Gita that to be a bhakti, you have to be devoted to something. And therefore, you at some point, you're going to have to give up this subject-object distinction. So why not? Why get into it in the first place? He makes the point that, you know, can you afford to use dualism to reach non-dualism? And as long as you're aware of it and the method works, then you'll go beyond the method at some point. So just acknowledging the problem. But I just wanted to let you know that sometimes the bhaktis get a bit of a hard time from other parts of yoga. As I say, it's really what I consider a path of the heart. And Ram Dass says it's like the lubrication. Devotion is like the lubrication that can grease your process towards awakening and make the whole thing so much easier, because you have, when you have an intense feeling of love, then you're sort of can urge you to move on, move towards your path, whether that's love of truth or love of God or love of the void or whatever your love is. It's just, you know, it's what matters in your heart, whatever's happening in your heart, it's that kind of intense emotional commitment to whatever is happening then that sort of can spur you on. So, excuse me. So yeah, it really is, a beautiful path. And I think it sort of leads to the question, so what is devotion? What is devotion? And I was looking in the dictionary and it said, well, devotion is prayers and religious observance, but it's also love and it's also loyalty. And so when we're thinking about, you know, are we a devotional person? Is our life, is the path for us a devotional one? We often know by how we feel. That's one of the challenges with Bhakti Yoga. It's really a feeling inside of you that, and it's about love. So I wanted to share with you this story that Krishna Das told me. So those of you who know me know I'm a huge Krishna Das fan. And if you don't know him, he sings devotional songs. He does a lot more than that, but much of what he does is he sings devotional songs to, and they're, you know, Sanskrit-based songs, they're Indian, Hindu-based songs. And he also hosts workshops, and I've had the pleasure of meeting him personally and interviewing him for a story about the love of his guru and the love of Hanuman that he has. And I strongly believe that the only reason he holds these workshops where he says anything is just because people pay and they turn up and he feels obliged to. What he'd much rather be doing is just singing. Because it's in that state that he feels that he's really like worshipping or tuning in, or he's sitting in love when he's singing. And if you ever hear him and sing with him, you might feel it too. And I certainly do. I just love singing the songs of God, singing the names of God with him. But he does, as I say, tell some stories about his time that he spent in India. I'm probably going to butcher this story. So if you have an opportunity to go to any of his workshops, I'm sure he'll tell this story again. He tells it often. It's worth going to hear it from him. But he tells the story of how he was spending time in India with his guru, Maharaji. Ram Das was actually there at the same time. And they were completely in love with Maharaji. and obviously, you know, there are all these Westerners turn up and become sort of crazy about this guru. But obviously lots of the Indian people who lived there or traveled there were also there at the ashram. And, you know, they felt like maybe Maharaji was a bit softer on the Westerners than he was on the Indian people there. And so someone asked him about it and said, you know, what's going on? And Maharaji said something like, I the gift I give these Westerners is that I let them love me. And when Krishna Das tells the story, he gets very choked up about it. And I thought to myself, well, this is, you know, it's really worth contemplating. What does this mean? The Maharaji says, my gift to them was that I let them love me. And I think this starts to unravel a little bit about what is devotion. What is devotion? And sometimes when we think about a path, we can intellectualize and think it's we will feel loved by whatever it is we're serving or committed to. But actually what this kind of revealed to me, this story, was that actually devotion and the path of devotion is one of giving love, is one of being able to express love. And when Maharaji says, you know, my gift to them is that I allowed them to love me. I let them to love me. It sort of shows you that one of the biggest blocks we have on this path is that we feel we are not allowed to love. And so, some deep contemplation of this, and I was thinking about the people in my life and what I felt devoted to and what devotion meant for me. And I say this then with no offense to anyone in my life, but the love of my life is my dog, is absolutely my dog. And it can sound crazy saying it. She's a 9-year-old German Shepherd mix dog, and I've had her about 7 years or so. I rescued her when she was about 2. And as I was thinking about this love I have for my dog and what that is, and maybe that can give me some clues. And what I realized about my dog is that she lets me love her completely and utterly. I don't think my dog would ever leave my side. There are no too many ear rubs. There's not too many belly rubs. There's not too many kind words. There are no, there's always, I can always take her for more walks and feed her more. I could worship and love and love and love my dog, and she would just let me. And there's something really special about that, that I think cultivates in me more love, not just for the world. Not just for my dog, but also for the world. I know that my heart is far more open since I've had my dog. And so I felt very deeply that there's something there between this relationship of being able to love. Because even when we think about the people in our lives, and even our children, I watch with my brother and his wife and my nieces, that as my nieces get older, they don't always want to be loved on, they don't want to be fussed over, they're independent, they want their own thing to do, and as maybe we know with our parents, we sometimes feel or have felt sort of smothered by their love. And of course we have all these conditions around love that we develop as well, or maybe we feel like some people don't deserve our love, or they've wronged us and therefore we withhold our love from them. And so to really be devoted and for a path of devotion, what it means is it's allowing us to open our heart and just love and love more. And I'm sure it's something that we all consider, about what is it that we really want to do with our lives. I remember having this question, I don't know, about 5 years ago, and I have many things I enjoy, and I was so confused because I love doing so many different things, and I thought, well, my purpose must be to do something, to be of service. And then I contemplated it and I meditated on it, and I got the message that really all I wanted to do was to love. That was it. If there was just some way of loving more, that the idea of freedom and liberation to me meant stepping out of a cage that wouldn't allow me to love. So freedom means being able to love to the fullest capacity of my heart ever. And so how do I do that? That's sort of, for me, the path of devotion, the idea of reaching truth or our true nature or God is through getting rid of all those barriers that prevent us from loving. And I can't remember if it's Rumi or Hafiz who says about, that beautiful poetry about getting rid of the barriers to love. But I really feel like that is devotion. Devotion is being able to drop the barriers, to step out of the cage and just love, 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 love on something. And we so rarely get to do it. I mean, who, even our partners, may let us love on them, but at some point we may, start with the whole, well, maybe this is a power struggle, am I going to get hurt? Or so there's always something. So it's so anyway, this is this path of devotion. And if we listen to the Sufis like Hafiz or Rumi, it's like a sense of being drunk in love whenever you hear them speak about their beloved. Because I don't know who's, I always think of devotion as really being the realm of the Sufis. They're always talking about their beloved in terms of sort of being giddy with love. And in India, There are people who are this drunk on this love of devotion, this devotion that they have in their heart for God, and they're called the Mass. Let me type that in. Let me find this part I wanted to share with you, this story about the Mass. So, Ram Dass says, they're called masks or God intoxicants. And in the US, people like that would be considered psychotic or sent to mental hospitals. But there's a difference between psychosis and God intoxication. Because the masks are not really in the world, or screwed up about it because of their anxieties, the way psychotics are. Masks really is sort of, you know, their heart chakra is so wide open and they're just flooded with the experience of God. They have turned inward towards God and could not care less about their bodies or their role in the social scene. All of that has fallen away and they can't keep their scene together anymore. And in India, it's understood that people like the masks are undergoing a spiritual transformation. How beautiful is that? So these people who are giddy on love are seen as just like, wow, they're about to get there. And says Meher Baba used to go around and bathe the masks, and he would build places for them to stay, and he would take care of them in the ashrams. And no one else wanted to be around them because they were so crazy and flipped out and wild. And people were having stages of saying, you know, it's really inconvenient to have these people around. They're so neurotic. I wish they'd go away. But with our own quieting, says Ram Dass, a different sort of recognition comes. And we can really honor the fact that someone may be going through something very, very profound, a spiritual awakening. So at that time, they should be treated with lots of love and compassion. And I just think that's just such a lovely way of reaching God, is just kind of losing your marbles and being so drunk and giddy on love as you crack wide open. I was thinking of an experience I had in Thailand. It was about 5 years ago, and I'd spent some time at my yoga school there, Agama. And I'd maybe been there a couple of weeks. And during this couple of weeks, you know, it was a real beautiful period of intense prayer and meditation. We had kirtan and bhajan, so we were singing the names of God every night. We had mantras, we were chanting, and we were practicing yoga, the physical practice of yoga. And we're bathed in, you know, love, like the Swami's there and all these blessings, and it's on a ley line, and the whole community is very loving and open. You know, you go to sleep with the sound of the sea, and the sun's just not too hot and not too cold. And I was with my best friend at the time, and we were eating healthy, and it was just, you know, all the right things happening. It was so beautiful, and I just was so happy and peaceful. I had a moped, and I was riding on my moped up to the school studio, and I was really excited because I just knew I was going to have a new learning, a new initiation, and be with amazing people. And as I was riding up the hill, I felt this feeling come over me, and it was very familiar, and I realized that this feeling was one I've had many times in my life when I've fallen in love, and I was like slightly giddy but really at peace. And when you analyze what it feels like to fall in love, it actually becomes very beautiful meditation. Like, my shoulders relaxed, it felt like, you know, a sense of relief, but also very open, and it was so beautiful. And in the split second I felt it, I just thought, oh, I'm in love, that's so interesting, who am I in love with? And I sort of scoured my brain quickly to try and find someone who I must have had a crush on or was in love with, and there was no one in my life at that time that was of any interest to me other than God. And it was so beautiful, and I realized in that moment that we don't need this subject object. You can just fall deeply, deeply in love with life or God or whatever you want to say. And that feeling is an experience you can have. And it blew my mind, and it lasted, I would say, maybe 30 seconds. But I just very deeply remembering, and it's always stayed with me. So, I've always sort of felt that that devotion is, and I believe it's because I was really devoted in those days, that I actually had this sense of just being in love. Not as crazy as the masks in India, but it certainly was very beautiful. Okay. So how does devotion take us to God? Well, obviously, as I've just, we've just talked about, it is because it cracks us open. That being, there's something about being able to give love that opens our heart up further. And Ram Dass talks here about his relationship with Maharaji. And he says, my relationship to Maharaji is a relationship of the heart, a relationship of love. And my love for him started out in a very dualistic place. I wanted to rub his feet and look at his form and be around him. And then as time went on, it was not that the love grew less, but that the love grew different. It kept growing deeper and deeper until I didn't really care anymore whether I was with his form or not. And then as the love went deeper still, I was no longer even relating to that man in India. I was relating to his essence, and I began then to experience it within myself in relation to him. And the whole quality of the relationship kept changing and changing as I grew in wisdom and as my heart opened and as my surrender went deeper. And he says, I kidded about it by saying that I worshipped his form, and I finally realized that it was just the doorpost to the real thing. So I was rubbing the doorpost and worshipping the doorpost, and then I saw it was just the doorpost. And then I saw beyond it. And that is the way devotional practice works. We make use of the guru or the object of the love. And that love awakens in us and brings us to the doorway. And then we look through, and what we see draws us in and in and in. Devotion as a method takes us right back into the innermost part of ourselves, right back into the unformed. But it greases the skin for us. Love, love, love this. It's so beautiful. And Parahamsa Yogananda also offers some sort of insight as to what it is about devotion. And he says, just as a person who uses the right methods to squeeze olives or grind mustard seeds will be able to extract the hidden oil in the end, so too the devotee to whom God isn't perceptible in the beginning will find him by the pressure of loyal devotion. So many promises about devotion, and so many promises in the Gita about devotion that we're going to talk about right now. So, what should be the object of worship? And the Gita talks about this. So, as my experience in Thailand was, there was nothing that was the object at the time. I can only feel that it was my devotion to love or to just being in the present moment. Obviously my dog is part of my devotion. But now, who do we devote ourselves to? Do we devote ourselves to a guru? Should we devote ourselves to a master or a sage? Do they have to be living? Or is it okay if they're dead? Is it okay if it's just like unmanifest form? And the Gita very kindly talks about this in chapter 12. And so I'm just going to read a couple of these verses. So Arjuna asks Krishna this very sensible question. So which devotees are better established in yoga? Those of steady devotion who worship you in one form or another, or those who worship you as the formless? And Krishna says, those who continuously think of me with zeal and sincerity and worship me manifest in one form or another are perfectly established. So whether it's whether you're worshipping Krishna as Christ or Buddha or a sage, at a temple or an effigy, it's all fine. You're perfectly there. And what of those who worship me, he says, in the unmanifest condition, beyond name and form and the infinite, beyond the grasp of the mind, unchanging, immovable, eternal? Certainly, those devotees are the same. They come to me as well. So he's saying it doesn't matter. But then he goes on, however, those who seek me as the unmanifest choose a more difficult way, because it is very hard for one in the body to reach that goal. How's this? Anyone can hear me now? Okay, great. Okay, sorry about that. But yeah, every week it happens, halfway through, just completely lose the mic. Don't know why. So I don't know where I was getting up to. I was going to just talk about, we're sort of looking at, you know, what should be the object of our worship. And really, it's anything, it's the quality of our devotion and it's being able to surrender into it. And Ram Dass has this lovely paragraph in his book where he talks about Maharaji and what it meant. And it says, the essence of my relationship with Maharaji is to love him, to open myself to his presence, to surrender to him, and that's my bhakti practice. But those qualities of love and openness of surrender are the essence of every bhakti practice. We find some being that draws our heart. It could be Maharaji or Anandamayima. It could be Christ or Krishna or Amma or Allah or God. You pick the name. And then we invite that being in. And we install that being in our hearts and we offer ourselves to it. And we sing to it and we chant to it. We pray to it. We bring it flowers. We love and we love and we open and we open. And then we watch and slowly, slowly, but surely, surely, we love our way into becoming it. It's just so, so beautiful. So I'm just checking my notes here. So how do we worship? And as he's mentioned here, we sing and we chant. Well, for the Gita, there are some sort of, there are specifics. And the specifics is really just, it's the essence that you bring to it. And so it says here in chapter 9, whatever is offered to me with true devotion, if only a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or a sip of water, I accept it because it is given with love. And then he mentions back here, those who sincerely perform religious rituals and continuously sacrifice to me, and that is sort of always think of me, in time will see their hearts purified and their lives free from the last taint of wrongdoing, and they will naturally rise to the high realms of the gods. I provide everything for the person who wants me above everything else and constantly thinks of me. I add to what he already has and I comfort him with absolute security. So I just wanted to share this story of a puja. So a puja means sort of a way of worshipping. And there are many different pujas that you have depending on the devas or the gods in India. But it can also just mean your own personal sort of ritual for worship. Where is this one? Okay. So in India and neighboring countries, and this is Swami Sachidananda telling this story, in India and neighboring countries, when you go into the countryside in the early morning, you may be surprised to see the lady of the house coming out and waving a camphor light and prostrating herself before a round ball. Look closely, and you'll see it's nothing but a ball of cow dung, which she herself collected from the backyard. Can you imagine that? Every morning she goes into the yard. And almost every family owns one or two cows, and of course there's cow dung produced overnight. And she selects a small piece and rolls it into a ball. The rest will go into a pit. But she brings this one ball to the front of the house. She puts a geometrical design around it, plucks the flower, sticks it right in the middle of the cow dung, and for her the dung becomes Lord Ganesh, God the protector. After that's done, she immediately offers more flowers and then prostrates before the Lord, offering the camphor light and says, Lord Ganesh, please protect my house the whole day. And that ball will be there through the day and through the night. And the next morning, it will be put to one side because it was worshipped as God. It won't go in the pit with the other dung. It is kept separate. And then every day for months, these balls are collected. And then one day, all of them are burned to ash. And that ash is called vibhuti, the holy ash, and that is the ash that is applied across the forehead in some pujas. So you may have seen the ash, or maybe you've received the ash on your forehead. That's vibhuti, and that's where it's from. It's this holy, holy ash. So she washes her hands when she's using, touching the rest of the dung, as if she's touched something very dirty. But that same dirt becomes God in that one little ball, and she worships it. And God bestows on her, says Swami Satchidananda, all the boons that she wanted. God doesn't say, can you select something else, please? At least use a nice stone. Nope, he just accepts her sincere devotion and he blesses her. So I think that's so such a lovely way that, you know, whatever you do is with the heart that you do it, however the ritual turns out, whatever is used in the ritual. And so there are several things that the Gita talks about. It talks about yajna, and so offering consecration all the time, which is, as I said, making something sacred. So yajna is one way of worshipping, like we do at the beginning when we come together and offer up the benefits for everything, offering yajna before your meals. Also japa. Japa is repeating the names of God as a mantra. And you could use like beads to get you through that. Or you could sing as Krishna Das does, singing the names of God. But above all, it is really about the essence. And there's another short story here. So in Eastern countries, when a farmer harvests something, he takes a little and he says, this is for God. And that first bunch of bananas from the tree is given to God. Anything that comes first is offered. Even when a cow gives birth to a calf and begins to give milk, the first day's milk is offered to God. The rest we may drink. If you ask the farmer why he does that, he might say, well, we give it to God first, he'll give us more. And it is kind of transactional, yes, but still there is a connection to God. And then the Gita talks about how you can start off with this kind of transactional devotion. If you're looking to cultivate your own devotion, you could start off like that. So you could have a little shrine set up and light some incense every day and say a prayer in hope that you get something from it. But then slowly over time, you'll open and it'll crack a bit more, and then you will just begin to fall in love with the act itself. So I don't know if you're into prayer. I'm sure you are. But I think about prayer as being one of those things. So when I look back on all the prayers that I've made in my life, I can't remember what I prayed for. And I can't remember what I prayed for and didn't get or did get. Like, it's just, it's not even there for me. So what I sort of realized about myself is prayer is just, it's something I need to do. It's something I love to do. It's in the act of doing it that that I feel like an opening. It's the loving itself. It's the speaking with God. So that is sort of my devotion. It's a lot of prayer. I also like to sing, and I write songs about God, or about being moved by God. I have my own little shrine with many different things around it, and I offer flowers every day to the shrine. And so these small things, I can't claim to be like this woman with her dung that does this every day and have this pure heart, but we gradually build up to it, sort of set ourselves in the fire of love. That's what the Sufis say, that we just, by beginning to open our hearts to becoming more love and extending our love, that we gradually get burned within it. So I wanted to share this other story, excuse me, because it's so colorful, and we have time, so I'm going to do it. And it's about devotion. And Swami Satchidananda is telling this story. So Saint Kanapa, his name was, when he was a youth, was known as Tinapa, which means chubby boy, chubby little boy. And as a child, he was quite strong and solid, and so he was called this chubby thing. And he grew up to be a hunter. And one day he goes hunting with two friends, and at one point they're chasing a wild boar, and as they aim their arrows, the boar runs over a hill. So they chase the animal over this unfamiliar hill and come to a small shed. And they think to themselves, well, who lives in this shed? What is it? Who's inside? And Tinapa, the chubby boy, opens the shed and he sees a Shiva lingam there. It's like a shrine. And he says, oh my goodness, this is a Shiva lingam. People worship this. So maybe it's his past samskaras. Maybe it was a former life of his. Who knows why he knows this is a Shiva lingam, but there's something in him that's ignited. And as his friends continue on the hunt, Tinapara sort of becomes madly attached to the Shiva lingam, and all this devotion rises up in him, and he cries out, oh my dear Lord, you know, you're all here alone. And he sees the Shiva lingam, the shrine, as God himself. And he thinks, who takes care of you and who feeds you? And no one's bathed you and you must be terribly, terribly hungry. So he thinks, well, you know what, I'm going to give you a bath and some nice food. So he runs to the bottom of the hill and he looks for this pig and kills it and begins to barbecue it. Then he roasts the flesh and keeps tasting it to check that it's just good enough for God. And then he throws away the parts that aren't good. And then he takes all the best bits on a banana leaf and goes up the hill. And then he remembers he needs to first bathe the deity before he offers food. Only he doesn't have anything on him to carry water. So he goes and he sort of rinses his mouth to a watering pool, and then takes a big mouthful of water, and then runs back up the hill with his pork stuffed in a banana leaf and in his pocket, and the water in the mouth. And he gets to the altar, and he leans over this shrine, the Shiva lingam, and he spits the water out all over it to clean it. And then he places all this pork, sort of covered in lint and bits of dust from the banana leaf, on the shrine, and he's really happy because he felt like he's looked after God. And he dances around in joy, and he says, every day I'm going to come back and do this, and you'll never be alone, God, I love you. So what Tinapa didn't realize, however, was that on the other side of this hill was a village, and there lived a Brahmin priest who actually came every day to this hidden shrine and worshipped there and left. I'm covered in spittle and old pork, and he's devastated, and he thinks, you know, someone is desecrating this temple. And so he sort of he cleans it all off. He comes back and he does this special puja, and he worships, offers some words of worship, and he offers flowers. And he says, please, you know, forgive me for this happening, because he's a very devoted man too. And he worships with great sincerity and devotion, and he leaves. And then that day, Tinapa comes back and he sees the flowers and he says, my God, someone only left you flowers, God. They didn't give you anything to eat. So off he goes again, and he gets the pork, and he comes back, and again he bathes them with the spit from his mouth, and he pours the pork all over it, and then he's so happy and he dances around with joy. And every day this happens, this battle between the two, until the Brahmin is absolutely in despair, and he just can't cope anymore. So he prays to God. And God appears to him in a dream and says, don't worry, you are a great devotee, but there is an even greater devotee worshipping you right now. He's a hunter, and all he knows is about giving pork. He doesn't know any rituals, he doesn't know, but I love his form of worship. So tomorrow, after your own, hide there, and you will see true devotion. So so the Brahmin hides behind the shed, and so he can see in, and he watches the hunter, chubby boy, arrive and do the water spittle and put the roast pork down. And then as Tinapa is about to dance with joy because he's done his ritual for him, he no longer sees the shrine in its stone form. He actually sees God. And as he looks at God, he notices one of God's eyes is bleeding. And Tinapa stops dancing and he begins to cry and he says, oh my goodness, what can I do? So he gets some herbs and he comes back up and he tries to put herbs on God's eye. And it's not working. And in the end, Tinapa says, you know, an eye for an eye. I'll pull out my own eye. So he takes a quiver of his arrow that's very gruesome, plucks out his own eye, and then pushes it into the socket of God's bleeding eye. And he takes away his hand and he sees that God has an eye back. And so he starts to laughing and dancing, becomes so happy again. He's not even thinking about his own eye, which is gone. And then all of a sudden he sees that the other eye of God is bleeding. So now he doesn't know what to do. He says, I have one more eye for you. I will give that to you. Only if I take my eye out, I won't know where you are because I won't be able to see you. So he puts his foot on God's face against God's cheek. and he begins to sort of work out his other eye with his arrow and then finally pops it out, and then pushing his foot into God's cheek just to check that he's there, he plunges his eye back into the other eye socket of God. Can you imagine this? So this Brahmin is watching, and he begins to shake, and he thinks, my God, what devotion. And then he sort of faints, and God appears. And that moment, God appears to Chubby Boy in more grandeur than ever before, and then they call him Kanapa, the saint, which means the eye fixer. And God says, Kanapa, stop. I'm so satisfied with your devotion, and I wouldn't have allowed you to go through this pain, other than there is this poor man, this poor Brahmin outside, who is also a devotee. And I wanted him to see what true devotion is. And Kanapa, his eyes are given back to him and his sight returns. So Swami Sethi then understood, this isn't a story, this is actually true, and it did happen. There were 60 great saints, and Kanapa was one living person. So the point is, of course, that it doesn't matter how you worship, and whether you know specific rituals, it's actually the essence that we bring to it. Okay. And Krishna says, think of me constantly, devote your life to me, offer all your actions to me, bow down and surrender before me. Thus you become steady on your path to the supreme goal and come unto me. Body, mind, heart, ego, everything towards this one goal. And it's called Ananya Bhakti, and that's completely, totally one-pointed devotion. So always, always thinking of God. And that really is, you know, where ultimately the path of devotion will take you, and at some point you'll just merge into God. So just to sort of end up with for this evening, I was sort of scouring around the web and looking for beautiful stories of devotion, and I came across this lovely piece of writing about devotion. So I just thought I'd read it before we end tonight. And it's by a poet. It's not a poem, but it's called Justin Arlen. And I recommend it if you come across it. And he says, the paths of our devotions are visible, worn into steps of churches, across the wooden thresholds of our homes, and through the grass around the yard. My grandmother ground a path between her front door and the barn. For more than 20 years, she passed back and forth each morning before dawn and dusk again, a pilgrimage to milk the 50 cows she kept, and which I believe kept her too. My own devotion over the years has been to writing, to poetry, but also lyrics and music, personal essays and memoir. The letters along the middle row of my computer keyboard, A, S, D, F, also T, I, and O on the top row, are worn off from my fingers touching them. They are letterless keys. Funny enough, when I look at the keys, I can't recall which letter I'm hitting, but my fingers remember. It is this gentle, repetitive wearing that wears us too, like the shape of feet molded into a pair of shoes or gloves that retain the fingers' bend, or the muscles of our legs from walking the contours of our environment. The daily excursions we make have major consequences in our lives on how we wear and how we are worn. And he goes on to talk about how he often thinks of his grandmother, who apparently just had this dream of being a dairy farmer and gave up a lot of what she was doing. She gave up playing the violin and painting, and even gave up her husband to become this dairy farmer. And he says, whenever I don't feel like writing, or I'm too tired, or I think it's too difficult, I think of her walking to the barn, regardless of the weather, never complaining. And I write because I've known for one long time, one simple unchanging reality. Writing is how I want to spend my life. And then he goes on to say that without devotion, he wouldn't be able to write. So only when I bring my intention and attention to an act, a commitment to write daily, did I experience the creative life I'd always imagined. This, I believe, has universal application. What are we devoting ourselves to daily? Is this worth our devotion? What else could we surrender ourselves to? How do we measure what we give and what it contributes to and extracts from your life? And is it a good exchange? Each morning I light a stick of incense and I place it in a bowl before I begin my daily practice of writing. The moment I strike the match, I become present and drawn into my sacred space. The other day I realized there are dozens of burned down sticks protruding from the bowl. Each stub represents a day I came, sat and wrote. I didn't always write a lot and I didn't always write well, but I came and I wrote regardless. Just as the groove my grandmother wore in the ground was evidence of her coming and going, the incense and worn bare keys of my computer offer evidence of how I spent a life. And I understand this is how a life is made. It is one tiny movement at a time. Saint Teresa of Avila said, "We can do no great things, only small things with great love." What we do with the time we take, how we do it, he says, mindful, present, joyful, with intention, in prayer, with love, as a gift, makes our life. And I thought this was just such a beautiful way of looking at devotion and looking at our life as devotion. So sort of taking time in everything we do, and those repetitive devotions that we make, and all the small movements that we make towards God ultimately create this beautiful life of devotion, this beautiful opening where we, as Ram Dass says, and sort of love our way into becoming what it is that we're actually looking for. So that's it. There's a lot to go over in Bhakti Yoga. Thank you. And a lot more to be said. So maybe we'll pick it up another time and talk more about gurus. But for tonight, I'll let you go. And thank you so much.